This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly look at the best in architecture, craft, furniture and fashion. I'm Josh Fennett. Today we've got a mixed bag of design delights to tempt you.
The criminal justice system was something I just was told to stay out of and ignore. Like, just don't go near that system. It's sort of amazing as a Black person in this country where you're just, they're just systems that you're like, yeah, they're racist. I just can't go anywhere near them.
First, we look at the problem with prisons and talk to a firm in the US that's designing spaces that challenge the mass incarceration model.
Research is living in the place for X amount of years, going to the beach, seeing these rocks. You know, I've lived there for 15, 20 years.
Plus, we talk about typography in Ireland and see how Galway City and Blackrock in County Louth got tempting new typefaces.
What are the tools and the materials and the, you know, design methods that can be used to make a building that is comfortable for that sort of, you know, European subject?
We shoot the breeze and talk to an author of a new book about how design kept us cool before the advent of air conditioning. Now there's a refreshing thought. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24. First up, we're judging the success of jails as buildings. Long designed to limit the freedom of their occupants and sadly diminish their dignity too, prisons have long fired the architectural imagination as well, from Bentham's Panopticon to putting inmates on an island a la Alcatraz. Enter Dana Van Buren, co-founder of Designing Justice plus Designing Spaces, a California-based architectural practice and development firm that's keen to question the current model of running prisons. How? By addressing the root causes of incarceration, which include poverty, racism, and a lack of access to resources, as well as the shortcomings of the criminal justice system itself. No small task, then. Here's Van Buren in conversation with Monocle's Will Kitchens about her design practice and her task of trying to help end mass incarceration.
I wanted to be an architect since I was like a little kid. It was pretty obvious. I started studying architecture like 1990, so I've been doing this a long time. After finishing school at the University of Virginia and then Columbia University, I spent about 6 years overseas doing a lot of large-scale retail mixed-use development work, really big projects for very wealthy folks. Came back to the U.S. in 2005, doing more large-scale projects for wealthy folks like Pixar and, you know, real estate developers and higher institutions of learning and rich people's houses and all of those things that architects do. But I also saw that the public interest design movement was being ignited. And I realized, well, I want to practice like that. You know, I want to practice for people who look like me. I think design matters and space matters. And I'm tired of working for wealthy folks who dictate the built environment. So I had heard at the same time about restorative justice from Fania Davis and Angela Davis, great civil rights lawyers and activists. And so the criminal justice system was something I just was told to stay out of and ignore. Like, just don't go near that system. It's sort of amazing as a Black person in this country where you're just, they're just systems that you're like, yeah, they're racist. I just can't go anywhere near them, right? That there's sectors of our society where we understand and are very clear that they're not for us. And it's kind of an amazing way to live, right? You just live knowing that and trying to compartmentalize parts of society so you don't get killed or burnt. And so when I heard about restorative justice, I thought, well, here's a system that is about people, right? It's about healing relationships, is about repair, sort of bypasses the white supremacist and racist sort of infrastructure and thinking that we see in criminal justice. And I wanted to use public interest design thinking and apply it to that. Like, I want to build for restorative justice as a new way of addressing harm in our community. So I started a firm in 2011 before Designing Justice called Form Design Studio, where I was sort of robbing Peter to pay Paul. You know, I was working in video games and using that money to investigate and start to develop spaces for peacemaking and restorative justice, which kind of worked. But what I realized during that time was that we could design the infrastructure, right? We could design these new models for justice, but we don't have any way to pay for them, right? They don't fit into the financing and procurement structures that we have for our architectural world. Like, tax dollars aren't paying for it. The school's not going to pay for it. You know, developers aren't going to make money off peacemaking centers. Like, how do you pay for it? The way that we build and pay for infrastructure is so limited. And so I realized we had to become finance and real estate developers as well. And that's when Designing Justice, Designing Spaces was born.
And for someone who's unfamiliar, maybe you could define for our listeners what exactly restorative justice is.
it's a philosophy and it's a practice of repairing harm. And it's a specific program that gets implemented in a community to divert people out of court. So restorative justice is actually an old way of doing justice. And it says that when a harm has been committed, it is a breach of relationship, and that the needs of those who've been harmed have to be addressed, and that those who have done the harm are accountable and have a responsibility to make amends and repair that breach. That's a radically different framing than the criminal justice system we have, where it's like, oh, who's guilty? How much we should we punish them? And the thing is about restorative justice is it works. Like, it works, you know, and it's about an eighth of the cost. And it's growing. If you know the Truth and Reconciliation Courts of South Africa, if you know the Gacaca Courts of Rwanda, Victim Offender Dialogue, there's a range of situations, conditions, practices around restorative justice that are essential to potentially repairing the incredible harm that we do to one another. And that's what we're committed to seeing as a transition in our communities. And if you want to know what it looks like, that's a whole other thing. It looks different depending on the culture that you're in. Mm-hmm. Rwanda or Sierra Leone, it's a tree. It's a peace tree. You designate a space in your community where you do the practice. It's sacred. And that's where you go.
And I know you've designed a diverse range of different projects, from mobile schools to sort of the refuge rooms that I was looking at, the Center for Equity. Maybe you could give me a bit of a rundown on how this principle of restorative justice has played out within the different contexts that you have worked and designed in.
I mean, restorative justice is only a small or one component of the work that we're doing. That was sort of the doorway to this sort of constellation of spaces. I mean, we've got three buckets of work. So the first, like when we talk about restorative justice spaces, is restorative reinvestments in community. And that's what most of our work is. Like, what do we need to build in the community for wealth creation, for healing, to support people's emotional and physical health and wellness, to get them access to resources? Restore Oakland is an example of a project like that, that has restorative justice in it, has a restaurant that trains low-wage restaurant workers to get living wage jobs, that has community organizing space that they own, right? Then we also have restorative reentry, right? So folks are coming back from prison and jail. And if we really, really want to decarcerate, if we really want to end that system, this whole infrastructure of reentry has got to be built, and it hasn't been. And there's no financing structures for it. And people aren't, like, I just heard today on the radio, letting folks out of Santa Rita Jail, which is a local jail, and they're ending up homeless, right? But there's nowhere for people to go. So we're really working hard to build reentry housing, reentry campuses. We start a new project in New Orleans to create a decarceration complex for women coming out of prison. And then the third bucket is repurposing and reimagining criminal justice infrastructure. We are abolitionists. We want to end the use of incarceration altogether. So we want to close prisons and jails, but we build a lot of them, y'all. Like, there's a lot. And they're huge. They were expensive to build. And there's a whole range of ripple effects when you close these facilities. So you have to repurpose them and rethink them. And so the Center for Equity in Atlanta, which is the transition of the Atlanta City Detention Center into a Center for Equity, is an example of that. We're doing a lot of that work now around the country.
Is that conversation larger than just prisons? Say courts, probation, is that idea of abolition larger than just prisons? Does it just sort of apply to every aspect of the criminal justice system as it stands?
The answer is yes. So all of it. I think we're waking up to, like, policing and the infrastructure of policing as being also a legacy of enslavement, the way that prisons and jails are in this country. And so those count too. Courts are terrible places to be. Nobody wants to be there. That whole infrastructure of adjudication, that's where restorative justice replaces adjudication, which is why we love it so much. That system also has to be completely rethought, and its infrastructure completely rethought, because it's all part of the same continuum. They're just the gateway to prison and jail. Courthouses are the gateways to prison and jail. But I know, you know, some studies have shown, you know, that restorative justice is an eighth of the cost of doing the punitive model, right? So you save some money there. If you're looking at what it costs to educate someone versus incarcerate them, it's a third of the cost, maybe even more intense. The cost of a jail could be $300 million, but I can build these sort of restorative justice and restorative economic hubs for like $10 million, right? So if you start to look at not just the sort of programmatic outcomes, but also just what the architecture costs, which is what we're mainly focused on, it's not even comparable.
Dana Van Buren there, speaking to Monocle's Will Kitchens. Thanks to them both. You're listening to a design show, so the odds are that you'll agree with me when I say a font can set the tone for a place. But if I asked you to think of an Irish font, the chances are you'd see a few Celtic squiggles in your mind's eye. But no more. Today, there are a wealth of Wiley studios weaving modern narratives with ancient landscapes and creating new identities while they're at it. Sebastian Stevenson is here to tell us more.
The year is 2020. The place is Galway. From all corners of the world, people have made the journey for the biggest celebration of Ireland's long and rich cultural legacy. Will you be among them?
Turns out the answer was no. That was a video from 2018 promoting Galway City on the west of Ireland as European Capital of Culture for 2020, twinned with Rijeka in Croatia. The programme has not panned out as hoped due to COVID-19, and in the last few weeks, Galway 2020 relaunched. Perhaps a typeface which was designed by Bobby Tannen may be a lasting legacy left for the city. It's called Galluv and is part of the Galway 2020 branding strategy designed by the Dublin-based agency Unthink. Galluv comes in a variety of different thicknesses. The sans serif font shows itself off in the right-leaning arches in the H and M's and at the top of the L that slants towards the right. This typeface with its sleek but jovial look is meant to be a more contemporary look for Galway, but as Colin Farmer from Unthink reveals, in Galluv lies all the ruins of Galway's past.
The process we underwent was a lot of physical research. We went spend a lot of time in Galway city and county, in the towns and graveyards and churches, and looking at shop fronts and old wayfinding and lots of old industrial locations that had remnants of typography that we could use as references. And when we had amassed enough material, we kind of shared that with Bobby and kind of looked at trying to develop our own voice, which was referencing all that material that we'd amassed.
Galluv will be made available for public use after Galway 2020 is finished. Heading to the other side of Ireland, we see a typeface begin to redefine a place. Grandson Agency, based in Dundalk, County Louth, has done work for the Black Rock Tourism Committee in County Louth. The final result is a serif font that looks like it has been carefully and skillfully bashed with rocks. The spine of each letter is quite thick, but as you get to the end of, say, a C or a K, it thins out into rocky edges. This jagged look is inspired by the rock formations on the seaside of Black Rock. Killian Walsh from Grandson explains how, as a resident of the village, he had to take on the project.
Suppose you want to design everything because you feel like you're going to have a good crack at it, and you know you're going to do it justice. And I suppose sometimes when you see something that hasn't been done as well as you would have imagined, it kind of it's definitely a gripe. And I think in this case it was like, if someone from outside of the community had been tasked with designing this, they mightn't have been as involved or committed to it as someone who, like myself, who's a resident of the area. So I think, you know, there was a vested interest in making sure that it was handled correctly. And then also from the point of view that, like, research is living in the place for X amount of years, going to the beach, seeing these rocks. You know, I've lived there for 15, 20 years. And it's a case of, I suppose, then putting on the design hat for it from a client design studio point of view and saying, right, well, I've lived here for this amount of years. What have I actually studied? What, you know, the plant life here, the fauna, the rocks, the history of the place. And I suppose you don't when you're living in certain areas, because, you know, it's something you might learn about in school, or you might get a pamphlet outside a shop and you can read up on it. Whereas with this, we fully threw ourselves into it.
While these two typefaces may be presenting a new image of Ireland, there is another typeface that distills an older Ireland. That typeface was designed by Jarlath Hayes and is called Tumun Seal. It was most visible on the Irish TV series Glenroe, which ran until 2001. The font was used on the show title in the opening credits. Its flat top and bottom, but heavily Gaelic middle, provided a bridge from the traditional Irish type to the international style. This year sees Tumansil be adapted and become Jarlath. The adaptation has been done by Max Phillips from the Dublin-based Signal Foundry. Max explains what he had to change when making Jarlath from Tumansil.
A lot of it was a matter of adjusting weights and proportions so that the typeface would be more balanced at smaller sizes, and that it would make a nice, even impression along a line of type so that the eye would move smoothly instead of in bumps and jumps. In some cases, I revisited decisions that he'd clearly been struggling with. For instance, there are very few in traditional Irish type. There really aren't much in the way of diagonal forms because the Irish alphabet itself doesn't include a K, doesn't include a V, doesn't include a W or a Y. So there really isn't much provision for those letters in the very rounded forms of the traditional Irish uncial. So what Jarlath did, because I think he was trying to make something modern, and I think he also wanted to make sure that it was readable, was to make angled forms for the K, angled forms for the V, which really didn't fit very well. And so in those cases, I would go back to the basic forms of the typeface and go back to the way these letters have been traditionally handled in other 20th century adaptations of this kind of letter, and I created more rounded forms.
Literature has shaped how Ireland is seen and sees itself, but maybe Ireland might now be shaped by the very letters themselves. From Monocle, in Ireland, I'm Sebastian Stevenson.
And our sincere thanks, Gura Míle Margat, as they might say in Ireland, to Sebastian Stevenson there for that report. Air conditioning is a modern obsession, but many of us are a little too breezy about the energy it all wastes. Not so Daniel A. Barber. He's an Associate Professor of Architecture at the University of Pennsylvania Stuart Weitzman School of Design. His new book, Modern Architecture and Climate, Design Before Air Conditioning, is out now and published by Princeton University Press. It explores the importance of climate-mediating design within the modernist movement, plus gives us some cues as to how it could help with building today. Barber spoke to Monocle's Charlie Filmer-Court, who asked what inspired him to write the book.
Knowledge about non-mechanical means to engage, you know, to think about the thermal conditions of the interior have been around forever, right? I mean, this has been one of the sort of projects of architecture from its beginning. In a number of cases, and even in the modern period, books and method, you know, manuals and method documents, certainly teaching tools have been made to encourage architects to think about using shading methods most effectively. You know, what hadn't been written and what hadn't been sort of clarified is the important role that questions of climate played to the ways that modern architecture developed globally. So while there had been a number of, I mean, the Olgiai brothers' design with climate is the kind of most obvious one in 1960s, some of Banham's work, even some of Le Corbusier's earlier writings, but there hadn't been a moment where that work had been brought together to really think about the role that climate played in the methods and practices and sort of design tropes and narratives of modern architecture, more broadly speaking. So that's what I really took as the project of the book, is finding a way to sort of bring those stories together.
Climate was essential to Le Corbusier's articulation of the principles of modern architecture in this interwar period. How important was his influence on the movement and the next generation of climatic modernists?
Yeah, I mean, and I think that, of course, it's important in thinking about that to be really clear that, you know, climate, of course, meant something very different in 1914 or 1920, 1930 than it does today, which is to say the kind of specter of climate change was not haunting these discussions. But really, the sort of project was to think, how can I, you know, produce a building, often in a place that from the kind of Central European perspective would be seen as a difficult climate, as too hot, usually, in the tropics. How can a building be produced that is still comfortable according to those, you know, those sort of European norms? And of course, this gets us involved in sort of questions of the universal models of the international style and, you know, Le Corbusier's claim that all buildings should be basically 68 degrees Fahrenheit, right? You know, the sense that it should be the same everywhere. So part of the project was to say, you know, before air conditioning, some decades before in many cases, what are the tools and the materials and the, you know, design methods that can be used to make a building that is comfortable for that sort of, you know, European subject. So this was a huge part of Le Corbusier's research in the 20s and 30s, and in fact into the 50s and 60s on slightly different terms, and informed his sort of global project, right, in the time that he spent in Buenos Aires and Brazil, and certainly and in very different ways in Moscow and Geneva and other places in Barcelona, were often sort of interpolated or thought through according to how these buildings would engage with climate on slightly different terms. As with most other discussions of architectural modernism, it's often difficult to overestimate the influence of Le Corbusier. I mentioned earlier the Olgiai brothers, who are central to the later sections of the book, and who really came to be known as the sort of climate design experts in the 50s and 60s, and they explicitly modeled their approach after that of Le Corbusier, you know, really saw themselves as Corbusians.
The other architects who feature heavily throughout the book are the Olgiai brothers. Why was their contribution so great?
It's an interesting question because it's a question that I think that the evidence suggests that, again, in the 40s and 50s and 60s, when they were especially active, thinking through climate, thinking through how a building took advantage of or beneficent climate conditions or sort of managed something that was a bit less desired. Part of what I argue in the book is that this was just sort of par for the course. This is just what architects saw themselves doing in a range of cases. And one can look across the sort of spectrum of many modern designers to see evidence of this. And of course, other books have been written to play this out more recently, but also back in the 60s and 70s. On the one hand, you know, the Olgiais are kind of unexceptional in the sense that they were trying to design initially in Hungary and then later on in the U.S., and saw climate as just one of the things that modern architecture was sort of set up to manage. In fact, one of its sort of selling points, if you will, one of the ways it could be argued as the correct solution, you know, that modern architecture as opposed to some classically derived style could be argued as a solution to a given project because of its capacity to manage climate.
The brise-soleil is pinpointed as an extremely important architectural feature in this period. Why was this?
Right. Yeah, I mean, the brise-soleil, the sunbreaker, the shading system, is really a sort of dynamic term that collects a lot of different possible systems and devices, right? And the sort of basic premise that a facade could consist of, you know, a glass wall, whether it be a curtain wall, but, you know, or just sort of window openings, that was then had a sort of second skin, if you will, that was a shading system, really allowed for a lot of different types of construction to be built around the world that could mitigate, that could manage different, what I refer to as kind of exterior climate conditions, right? The sort of geophysical system of climate according to the desired conditions on the interior. What I call at the end of the book, the planetary interior, in the sense that they're all being sort of managed and modified according to similar terms. So the brise-soleil was beneficial in part because of its variability, right? I mean, one could have a sort of fixed fin that blocked the sun at its highest point in the summer if that was all that was needed, or one could have a set of dynamic louvers or other sorts of shading devices that could be moved according to season, according to the day. Part of the reason the Brazilian work is so sort of exciting on these terms is that there was often two or three different shading devices on a given facade. So the brise-soleil is a sort of catch-all term to say an aspect of a kind of second facade that manages the incident of light and heat into the interior It really opened up modern architecture, broadly considered, to provide a sort of a pathway for these design systems to enter into many different parts of the world. What I call the globalization of the international style, in the sense that, you know, this was caught up also in economic systems and political systems that sort of brought modern architecture along with it in different ways.
The book begins by talking about the importance of Le Corbusier's Barcelona lotissements, but goes on to include buildings across Europe, Brazil, Iraq, the US, and many other countries. Was there a geographical epicenter of climatic modernism, or did the ideas generally just proliferate widely?
Well, I mean, again, I think yes and no. I mean, I think that there was a center in the sense that there were sort of centers of activity that moved at different times. Certainly Brazil in the 30s and 40s, as you note, I've already mentioned a few times, was a real place for experimentation. And that was in part because Brazil was a country that was really aggressively trying to enter into the global economic system, right? And enter into the geopolitical discourse that, you know, eventually oriented around the United Nations, et cetera, to sort of become a part of that community. And one of the things required was a certain type of commercial activity that implied a certain type of experience on the interior, right? So some of the first buildings that I examined in the Brazilian context were insurance buildings, and the sort of premise being that, you know, if you wanted to invest in a country, you of course needed insurance or even reinsurance. So the buildings for insurance had to be sort of comfortable to the northern corporate agent, right, who would come down and help Brazil enter into this broader economic sphere, right? So, you know, it's in the context that these were not exclusively stylistic gestures, but were intended to think through how a specific built condition could produce a set of physical, economic, political relations along with them. So while Brazil was an important center in the 30s and 40s, later on the U.S., right after the war, was an important site for research to clarify a lot of these issues in the context in particular of not only the American suburbs and their dramatic expansion in this period, but also in the context of buildings for embassies and other sorts of institutional and government buildings around the world, largely in the Middle East and Africa, but certainly more generally as well, where shading devices, shading systems of various forms were used to, again, sort of make those buildings familiar in some ways. And so far as the shading systems often had patterns that would attempt to reflect the traditions of the region, but also to produce, again, a specific condition of the interior.
In the interwar period, there was no choice but to moderate climate using different aspects of building. Do you think that there will be a return to this notion of addressing the problem within the design, as opposed to using air conditioning now that the climate emergency is becoming so apparent?
Yeah, I hope so. And certainly, you know, part of the project of the book is to sort of encourage architects and scholars in the field to look to some of these strategies and some of these projects as, if not necessarily sort of direct applied knowledge, certainly an opening up into some other sort of ways of thinking about how a building can exist in the world. The ways in which we provide comfort to ourselves, certainly in the American context, are very energy dependent, very fossil fuel dependent. And so finding ways to think about how we live in buildings, you know, part of what emerged simultaneous to air conditioning was a set of very rigorous standards to consider the kind of ways of life that would happen within a given structure, residential or commercial. So a lot of what we also will be facing as the climate changes and as buildings attempt to change along with them is rethinking how we inhabit spaces and the sort of habits and practices of clothing, but also of opening and shutting windows and shutters and shading systems and, you know, turning up and down heating and cooling systems, maybe with some different patterns to minimize our reliance on carbon-heavy systems that we certainly can't be using, well, shouldn't even be using today, but certainly shouldn't be using, can't be using for much longer.
That was Daniel A. Barber there, speaking to Charlie Filmer Court, and my many and sincere thanks to both of them. And sadly, that's all the time we have on today's show, but if you're game for a few more design-minded delights, then you could, of course, listen to our five-minute midweek sister show, Monocle on Design Extra, What Will We Talk About Next? That airs on Thursdays. Do subscribe so you don't miss a beat. For more delights, you could also subscribe to Monocle magazine, you could pick it out on newsstand, you could get it online, or you could sign up to our daily bulletins, why not the Monocle Minute among them. Head to monocle.com for more of that. Today's show was produced and edited by the ever-patient May Lee Evans. Thanks, too, to our researchers, Nick Manise and Charlie Filmer Court. Thank you both. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening. And until next time, goodbye.